free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net. See our past shows and archives, as well as what we have coming down the pike. Today is December 3rd, 2007. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Greer. He is the founder of the Disclosure Project, which is a leading expert on UFO suppression and associated advanced clean energy technology sequestration. Organization he founded recently called AERO, stands for Advanced Energy Research Organization, was established to protect and launch a revolutionary energy technology that meets the screening criteria of self-running with at least 1 kilowatt of usable electricity. We're delighted and honored to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
Well, we have quite a list of things we want to get through today. Talking about energy suppression, UFO technology. Ironically, today I was listening to a videotape by John Searle.
Right.
Pretty amazing technology. Give us an overview of the UFO suppression on one hand and the associated advanced clean energy technologies that go along with that, kind of a ballpark idea.
Well, what people have to understand are two sides of the same coin. We don't actually use the word UFO because that word was coined after the classified projects studying the matter had already identified them as two categories. One are the extraterrestrial vehicles, or ETVs, as they're called at the National Security Agency, and the second are what are called as the alien reproduction vehicles, which are made by Lockheed Martin and Northrop and a consortium of companies that have been studying the advanced physics behind high electromagnetic frequency alterations in, if you will, spin, mass effect, and so-called anti-gravity. So the ARVs in the early days were called flux liners, and these were prototypes being built in the 40s and 50s, and by the late 50s, they were fully operational. The early ones I know of classified programs and men that worked in them had basically a 24-volt marine battery as their power-up system. Then they went over unity, meaning that they were acquiring energy from the quantum vacuum flux field, and they would go. And that was all the energy payload that they had on them. So this was a technology of over 50 years ago. But it actually goes back much longer than that. As you know, all the way back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were advances in energy generation that Tesla and Stubblefield and others had. And then T. Townsend Brown in the 20s began studying the electrogravitic, the high voltage effects on mass, and doing experiments. And by the late 40s, early 50s, all of his work and the B-field Brown effect, as it was called, Dr. B-field at Princeton, who worked with Einstein, that work went black, as it were, very classified. And I have an Office of Naval Research document that describes their review of the B-field Brown effect and T. Townsend Brown's work in 1951, so that by 1954, essentially all of these operations, and I think Nick Cook of Jane's Defense Weekly did a very good job of documenting this, pretty much went off the radar scope of open source material, although up to 1954, there was actually quite a bit in mainstream aerospace journals talking about this so-called anti-gravity research that was being done. So the reason, of course, for the secrecy is not hard to understand, because if you have the knowledge of acquiring energy from the fabric of space-time, meaning not outer space, but the space around us, you can completely obviate the need for oil and gas and coal and nuclear power and centralized utilities. And this, of course, is a huge part of the global economic machine, and the power elites have not wanted to transition out of those systems because of obvious geopolitical interests. I think that the secrecy that surrounds these energy systems, whether it's a guy in his garage in Idaho or Searle in England or P. Townsend Brown working on this or Stan Meyer figuring how to do to correct frequencies to split hydrogen and oxygen off water, all of these end up getting suppressed for the same reason there's been extraordinary secrecy around the misnamed UFO issue, and that is all of it deals with the fact that once it's disclosed and known as a legitimate area of scientific inquiry and known by the masses, people will realize that we don't have to be dependent on fossil fuels and oil to run our civilization. But that, of course, is the crux of the question, and that is you have a $200 trillion-plus dollar asset base known as gas and oil and coal, and there's really only a few hundred corporations and families that own that asset base, and they are inordinately powerful and have not wanted this information out. Now what we're finding, however, is that a lot of these elites are waking up to the fact that they've overstayed this energy game a little too long, and I've been having meetings with some of these folks who say, you know, well, we really do need to bring these other things out. And but, again, no one wants to do it first. It's the old problem in America, and I think in the modern world, everyone wants to be first to be second. When you start dealing with something that's extremely not only controversial, but would have huge impacts on the status quo.
I would imagine there are discussions about how to break this out in a way that it doesn't look like they've been hiding it all these years, so they don't get egg on their face for being the bad guy and keeping this technology from us.
Well, what I have been told, and I'll be quite blunt about this, is that they're looking for a group like ours or yours or some group to come together that brings out at least a Generation 1.0 version of this, so that it can crack the door open, because it's very difficult for Lockheed Skunk Works to open up their little war chest of stuff and not have it be known that there's this long history that can be proven of them acquiring them, because there's an obvious inherent scandal in the fact that we are facing a global warming and Mideast oil wars and geopolitical conflicts and geophysical meltdown, which is all an artificial result of this enormous mistake that happened in the early part of the 1900s and was then compounded in the mid 1900s and the 1950s with these extraordinary advances in physics and energy generation being deliberately sequestered away from the public and even ridiculed. And at times ruthlessly suppressed up to and including intimidation and apparently assassination. So we're now at the point where most of these folks, I've been told now 70% or so of the guys who are involved with these issues think that this ought to be brought forward, but there's still a very vocal and strong third of them that don't want this done. My view of it is that, be that as it may, we have to provide some leadership about this, because it's unlikely that the centers of elite power are going to do this unilaterally. I just don't see that that's the way big steps like this happen. It usually happens from sort of out in left field. A group comes in, moves this forward, and that's what AERO is trying to do. And people can go to AERO2012.com to see what we're proposing to do. And we're actively looking for scientists to have a robust system that can be evaluated and proven to be a generation system that would meet our criteria and are prepared to give people a $200,000 upfront fee for that and guarantee at least $5 million within 2 years for licensing it and getting it out to the public. So we have very good support on our team. They're angel funders, as they were, as I might say at this point. But we have the means to do this. The question is the research community out there in the new energy field able to come up with this sort of system. We're hoping we'll see a big breakthrough here in 2008. My sense is that we probably will.
One of the things that comes to mind as I review the different accounts that I've come across of different energy technology that have been suppressed, it's almost as if in some cases the powers that be have a detection mechanism whereby, you know, similar to, you know, you have these goggles that they can wear for night vision.
Right.
They have satellites up there, and as soon as somebody builds one of these things, a light beeps up on this little dashboard of theirs, and they say, aha, we've got a guy over there in Midland, Texas, who has one of these things. Let's go get him.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that this is exactly why the overarching strategy that we use with the Disclosure Project is what we want to use with the energy disclosure effort, and that is the enemy of all of the scientists and inventors and innovators who've dealt with this is their obscurity. And when we did the Disclosure Project in 2001, it was the most watched event in the history of the National Press Club. It was eventually seen by hundreds of millions of people around the world. And the people who are sort of in a background support role of what we're doing are frankly very powerful and very well connected, including quite a few A-list celebrities in the United States and in Europe. And what I have said to people is that you're not going to be able to do this in an incremental way. The incrementalist view of this is over. And the other point that I would like to make, and you're absolutely correct in this, Sterling, is that anyone who thinks they're going to do this and remain off the radar scope of the interests who want to suppress it are frankly delusional. I have talked to so many inventors who say, well, I'm going to hide it in a rock crusher, or I'm going to hide it in a this, or I said, you're not hiding it from anywhere. They don't really care to bother anyone unless it looks like it's going to come out and make a difference in the status quo. So it's a sort of this catch-22. So what we're wanting to do is provide an umbrella and leadership effort so that the physicists and the engineers and the innovators can do what they do, and we can provide the protection and the disclosure muscle, if I can use that concept, to see that these things are known by a large number of people, because once you've squeezed the toothpaste out of the tube, you can't put it back in. Normally what happens is that these technologies remain rather obscure, and they are then discovered and are sequestered. And I do believe that there are very well-developed detection systems that are able to pick up when someone has something like this operating. In fact, I've been told that this is the case. And I'm reminded also of what Ben Rich, who was the head of Lockheed Skunk Works, told us before he passed away. He said, look, there are no private conversations anywhere on Earth, and I am quoting, and we have multiple witnesses to him saying this, and so a lot of these inventors think that they're going to sort of outfox the secret groups by being quiet or introducing it subtly, or, you know, and these strategies have been tried for 100 years, and they've all failed, and they failed because the ability of the this very well-funded and well-organized, and I might say extremely high-tech group, to identify people is substantial. So the only way I see this happening is for people who have these sort of technologies to be sure that they are, number one, protected by massive disclosure of their existence. And I don't mean within the new energy community per se, but I mean the entire planet's population. And you need to be able to put together a system to do that, because ultimately that's your greatest protection. You know, one of the things I remind people of is that we're now something like 6 years and a half past when we had this National Press Club event where we had 110 top secret military and intelligence witnesses come forward, named, rank, serial number, et cetera. And not a single one of them have been threatened. None of them have even received a phone call asking them to be quiet. We have not had any of that kind of action towards us. And the reason for it is that we have a multi-layered strategic security system in place that is protective, but also there's just too many people who are following what is going on with this. And so one of the things that has to happen with these technologies is that they need to move from the cradle of their birth, as it were, into prominence. Even if they're not ready to be sold to the masses of the population need to know about it, because that's your first line of defense, because it's only in the darkness of obscurity that these kind of shadowy interests are able to operate and get away with it. Because if you put a big spotlight on what's going on, they're sort of like cockroaches that run into the corners of the house when you turn the lights on. They're just going to not be out there because they do not want to be caught flat-footed in the middle of a suppression activity. But if an inventor or a technology group that's small, even of a few dozen people, is doing this sort of off the radar scope, they are very vulnerable, and the point I have made to people, whether they cooperate with Arrow in doing this or whether they do it on their own, I really don't care, except I can advise you, anyone listening that has these sort of technologies, that there is no way anywhere in the earth, in the deepest part of the Amazon, they could go to Siberia. They would not be able to develop these systems and begin to move them forward outside the cradle of their the birth site of the invention without it being known by this particular group of folks. And yes, they do have systems that detect them, I think, literally when they begin to operate and tap into the quantum vacuum flux field. And I think this is why it's important that we work together and that we work in a way that learns the history of the last 100 years of suppression and do a really thorough analysis, an ethnography, if you will, of the subculture of new energy innovation and what has happened, and learn from the past and not recreate the same mistake as we go into the future.
One of the counterarguments that I've heard to what you're describing here is that the political climate has changed substantially in the last 5-10 years. Global warming has become a major issue. If not number one, it's way up there in people's mind as to the threats that we face as a civilization. And there's renewable energies are becoming very popular. The industry is going crazy right now with new venture capital money going into some of these more mainstream technologies. And so the political climate now compared to 100 or even of 20 years ago is drastically different. There's almost an immediate
I agree with that 100%. In fact, to give you a measure of this, I was meeting on Friday, just 2 days ago, in Washington with one of the most connected up members of this elite club, and we were at the University Club in Washington. And this gentleman, who is connected into the who's who of the energy sector of the world, told me point blank that 3 years ago he would not have sat with me and had this conversation. Now he wants us to present whatever we can so that the friendlies within this group can get behind it. And so what I'm saying to people is that things have changed, and this is why we're able to go forward, and that people who have the knowledge of how to create these systems need to not be so timid, but they need to be wise in being bold. You know, being bold doesn't mean being reckless. Being bold means making wise choices so that you move forward and you take the people who are aware of what you just said, the environmental crisis, the geopolitical crisis with the oil and energy situation, which, by the way, is going to haunt us much sooner than the greenhouse gas problem and the global warming problem. And that is to be sure that the strategic capabilities are equal to the technology. What we've seen in the past, that people have great breakthroughs in these technologies, and they just think that if they have $5 million or $100 million or $200 billion, give you any number, that they can do it. The money is about 10% of the problem, and the device is about 10% of the problem. The problem is having the strategic know-how to leverage these things into the circles that you're describing, which are now on our side of the argument, which weren't there 5 years ago or even 3 years ago, as this gentleman was explaining to me on Friday in Washington. So I'm very optimistic that there has been a major sea change within a number of sectors, where people are waking up to the fact that we really do need to get off of the early industrial revolution's engine, and that is fossil fuel and coal and oil, and come into a true high-tech new civilization, and that the time to do that is absolutely right now. And there are people ready to support this, not just financially, which is important. I mean, it's not inconsequential that you know, obviously people need funding, but I think strategically and network support and institutional support, and that's what we have identified over the last 15 years. Our group has developed excellent ties into those sorts of groups and have been educating them quietly behind the scenes, as it were. And I think right now we have probably the best potential for bringing a new system out that there has existed in the last 100 years. In fact, I'm certain of that, and that's why we formed Aero. I think things have changed and evolved enough that we can make a serious run at this and succeed. And I'm not going to say it's going to be easy. I'm not going to say there aren't going to be a lot of challenges. It's not going to be universal support, but there's going to be widespread support even within these elite circles.
A couple of news stories I wanted to bring up along these lines, and also just a mention of a question I want to ask after we address these two news stories. And the question is, what's the difference between Aero and Seas Power, which predated it? But first, the two news stories. A week and a half ago, we ran a story saying that the Club of Rome, which is notorious for being behind such things as the September 11th event and other atrocities in the history of this planet, the masterminding of the conspiracy, if you want to use that word, which is what it amounts to, of these power elite, these black ops who are running the show and want to stay in power. The Club of Rome is taking leadership now in aggregating all of the European clean energy technologies into a clean energy grid, so that you have wind and solar and geothermal tied together for a 24/7 sustainable or always on, always dependable backup system type of thing. And they're spearheading this thing.
Right.
So, you know, they're jumping in and they're now saying, you know, we're the leaders in this. And you see Exxon and you see Shell, you know, trying to say, hey, we're clean. You see Chevrolet and these different big companies who have been the bullies in the past, now stepping up to the plate saying, we're the leaders. We're the ones who are stepping out on this issue. Last Friday, there was an event in London in which, this is the second news story I was mentioning, in which the rich and famous got together. Together, there was about $100 billion in net worth represented in this gathering of people. Al Gore was there, and among the things was supposed to be announced some new clean energy technology that would resolve our energy need and provide us with clean power. And I've been scoping the news to find a report of what was disclosed, and there's nothing.
Well, you know, you have to understand that this is a process, and what you're seeing with some of these announcements is exactly what I was just describing, is that there are a lot of people who now are on board doing this. Now, the first level of this is to say, yes, we'll do stuff with the biomass and different types of fuels and wind and solar and what have you. Now, these same entities certainly know that there are these more advanced systems, but they're laying the groundwork for the idea that we can phase out of fossil fuels. Now, this is exactly some of what I was talking about with this gentleman, this elite leader in Washington on Friday, and that is the time for incrementalism is over. That what you're going to see is we're either going to have our civilization brought to its knees, or we're going to transition quickly into serious replacements for oil and gas and coal and nuclear power and centralized utility grids, which are all creaky and falling apart all over the world. And that isn't going to happen through just solar and wind alone or biomass or what have you, because it's inadequate for the needs. You know, we have a 650 coal-fired power plants going online in the next decade in China and India alone, which will by themselves double global greenhouse gases, and that's if everyone else stopped using everything, which isn't going to happen. So they're realizing that we have an enormous need for much bolder steps. And in fact, that's what the crux of the conversation with this gentleman was about. And I have seen this in other circles as well. So what I think, however, we have to do is not sit back and think that these elements are going to do it. That we're going to have to continue to provide the leadership, because if the people lead and we continue to do the education, then these other groups are going to come along, and not all of them, and some of them may be Trojan horses that are pretending to cooperate when in reality they want to stay in a sort of metered society. You know, J.P. Morgan famously had told Tesla, you know, paraphrasing, that basically it said, this is great, this sort of technology, but I can't put a meter on it. And so, you know, how am I going to make the money? So I think that we have to continue to, while being encouraged by these sorts of things, be also a little skeptical and say that, look, we need to be sure that the new energy efforts that are the real breakthroughs, what I think will be the true solution to the energy and sustainability and environmental issues, which are these sorts of technologies, advanced physics, dealing with the so-called zero point or quantum vacuum field, electrogravitic systems, other closed energy systems that are not dependent on wind and solar, that could generate a lot of power. We're working right now. We have just issued a $100,000 contract for an engineering firm to build us a 10-kilowatt closed system that we hope will be done in the next couple of months to 3 months. We'll see how successful they are. So we're, you know, what we're going to do is continue to move forward while being hopeful that these sort of large and powerful entities continue to move in this direction, but not sit back on our laurels and thinking that Big Brother's going to actually take care of it, because I think that there's a saying. When I lived in Israel for 3 years, I got to know a lot of the Bedouin, and they had a great expression, trust in God, but tie your camel. And, you know, you need to do that.
One of the things that comes to mind as we're having this conversation is this whole question of the prophetic scenario, for lack of better terminology, that I've had in my mind for many years, is that you have this control paradigm, the conspiracy that is controlling things, that's running the show, and they have their heyday, and then their time comes to an end. They are upended, and a new remnant comes forward who are more enlightened, who are more loving, who are more personal responsibility-based, and a new society emerges that is much more enlightened than what has been there before. And there's kind of a meltdown in the middle of the collapse of the status quo as this new thing comes forward. It seems to me that there's a possibility emerging in which there could be more of a transition rather than a collapse and a phoenix rising out of the ashes scenario. And the phoenix rising out of the ashes would be the new society that's more enlightened, while the ashes would be the status quo. What is your take at this time on the transition that we're looking at? Are we going to transition without a huge meltdown, or is a meltdown somewhat necessary to undo the old guys and bring in the new?
Well, I think you have both twin processes going on contemporaneously, and I think that this is how things have always gone forward. And whether it's a meltdown for the, if you will, the old order of things, or a transformation, is really a matter of free will and choice. For example, Olivetti typewriters could have chosen to go digital, But they didn't, so they went bankrupt. The carriage makers, that made horse and horse-drawn buggies back in the 1800s could have chosen to go with automotive, but they were skeptical and they didn't. And most of them went, most of those coach works, not all of them, went bankrupt. I think what you have to see is that this is something that is a matter of vision, leadership, and quite frankly, a spiritual orientation to say, I'm willing to embrace the future in a positive, hopeful way rather than clinging on to the status quo. Now, this is why it's very difficult for governments to do this, because they're all about maintaining the homeostasis of the status quo, and they're all about maintaining their special interest group support. Because it's at this point, special interests run the governments of the world. But that is changing as well. So I think that you're going to see a transformation happen. Whether or not there has to be some elements of more traumatic collapse is wholly dependent on the wisdom of those grasping power, and whether they're willing to let this transition happen. One of the things I tried to explain, and I've certainly explained this in my most recent book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, is that one of the ways of looking at this is we can see this as a way that our civilization goes through this metamorphosis, and it can be as painless or painful as we choose it to be, but that if you are holding on to the old systems that have to go the way of the dinosaur, you're going to be drugged down with it. And to the extent that our society is embedded and is, as George W. Bush said, addicted to these fossil fuels and systems, to the extent that we don't come off that addiction in a very wise fashion, it could be a very difficult withdrawal. And, of course, we've had 100 years to do this. I have to remind people that there's, it was around 1900 that we really could have phased out of oil and gas and coal. But, of course, whether it was the Rockefeller Empire then, or the Saudis and other interests now, it really doesn't matter. There are very powerful interests that make a lot of money out of keeping people metered to a linear supply chain of fuel. But I think that many of these people, and this is one of the things that I ask people in their prayers and meditation and thoughts, is to see those sort of folks seeing a transformation that they can be part of, and they get excited about that. That, you know, people have to have something to look forward to and to live for. And you can't just present this as endless loss for these interests. You can say, look, this has been a good ride, but now look at the kind of civilization we could have on this planet that would have no pollution, the abolition of poverty as we know it, the establishment of true sustainability, and then eventually, with the more advanced versions of these systems, the ability to travel among the stars and explore the universe peacefully. I mean, that's one vision. And then there's this other vision that's very eschatological and terrifying of collapse and gloom and doom. But this is all about the state of the mind of the folks who have to proceed. And I tell people, let's put out the good vision, because that's ultimately what's going to prevail. And I think it's important for us to focus on that. And if we stay with that sort of consciousness and vision and action, more importantly, in that direction, it will create its own momentum and hopefully pull along the rest of these elements. I mean, some of whom may be recalcitrant and be dragged screaming and kicking into this new millennium. But I think for the most part, what you're seeing is that people are willing to embrace this vision when it's articulated, and they understand that it's a win-win situation.
I agree with you, and I would, to kind of solidify that, the antithesis of what you're describing is something that I think is working against the new energy field, and that is this paranoia that is out there of the bad guys that's out to get me. And
right.
the paranoia is it basically pulverizes it. It stymies progress. If people are so afraid to talk, they won't get on the phone, they won't send you an email, they
right.
won't talk to you, and the thing doesn't go anywhere because they're too afraid.
Yeah, we're dealing with several inventors right now who are hell-bent on being the tree that fell in the woods that no one heard, because of the past history of suppression. And what I say is, look, all I can say is that if you want to be anonymous, we'll do it with you anonymously. They already know you exist. If you want a lead group to stick its neck out to be chopped at and whatever, our group is willing to do that. I've been doing it for a long time. I did it for 10 years running a big trauma center where people came in with Tech Nines, and, we were almost killed several times in my emergency department. I'm willing to do it with Disclosure Project. I'm willing to do it with this. That's kind of why I'm on this planet, because I have this sort of, fearlessness about that. But I think that that's fine. I mean, everyone has a role to play. I can't hook up my DVD player without having my wife do it, because I'm an electromagnetic moron. But I have other skills. What we all have to do is come together and figure out what our skill set is. My skill set is being able to build these networks and lead these things forward and put together the strategic protection. That's what we want to give to these inventors. The inventors need to engineer and invent. The big problem is that there is this defeatist mentality, and I agree with you, where the paranoia becomes defeatist, where it says, oh, I can't do anything. They're going to come after me, like a Rottweiler, and I'm just going to sit here and keep this secret because it's too risky. But you know what? I think that thinking is the riskiest of all, because if we stay in that state of fear, we're going to manifest the outcome of that fear, and that is a terrible collapse for our civilization. So we have to kind of get a new consciousness and in a way, it's sort of a certain courage and spiritual selflessness to a point. I was talking to this man very bluntly Friday at the University Club in Washington, and I said, the real currency here is the willingness to have the courage of your convictions and have the selflessness to do something for the world beyond your own selfish ambitions. And I said that if we don't find people who can do that, our world is in serious trouble. And so on a certain level, the crisis we're in is a very existential crisis, is at its root, I believe, spiritual. And the solution is going to come from within ourselves. And I think the means for creating the civilization and bringing these sciences out are all there, and now we need to kind of figure out how to get out of our own way and do it. And when we do, I think we're going to be surprised how quickly the door is open for us.
One of the things that I think we ought to talk about for a minute is the new energy that's coming forward is kind of the opposite of the existing paradigm of a grid, that this all-powerful grid that could very vulnerable, actually. One terrorist bullet could take down the entire Western United States for months.
Right.
Somebody from the the Homeland Security told me that he was on task to help prevent that, just such a thing from happening. The new energy is such that each home could have in its garage the device that powers the entire house. Each car has its own power device. You don't have to stop and get fuel. There may be some maintenance and whatnot, and maybe fuel it up once a month or whatever with some kind of, some kind of maintenance thing to keep things going. But it's harvesting energy from the quantum or however you want to describe that. And so that is a very decentralizing paradigm. And so the leadership in the status quo right now who stand to lose their control, that's why I think it's interesting that this Club of Rome is looking to aggregate all of the renewable energy in Europe into a large grid.
Right.
Because that's what they know. That's how they operate.
Right. And what they don't understand is that the more you centralize power, the more vulnerable it is in this day and age. And that, ironically, real power comes from letting go and letting it become decentralized. So the real emanation of power, literally and figuratively, is coming from the individual and at the village level. And that is true sustainability. This old model of vast aggregates of wealth and power that are very centralized is a creaking mess that is headed for the scrap heap of history. And in fact, I was speaking, there's a group that deals with global risk management, and one of their big things that they're focusing is based out of Switzerland, and it's a lot of the global elites involved with this, is that they're concerned about the vulnerability of not just the U.S., but the entire world's existing power grid being extremely vulnerable to electromagnetic storms in space or a terrorist attack or just plain old falling apart. And I said, yes, but you see, these technologies, where you would have your home or your car running on a power plant extracting energy from the space around it, or even let's take some of the work that Stan Meyer had done. If you can develop a system that's over unity that electrolyzes hydrogen and oxygen from water on an over unity closed loop basis, every home in America generates 400 gallons of wastewater a day. And most of that is not sewage, most of it's gray water, which could be charcoal filtered, and you could run your house and car on it. So, you know, and people who complain about the water system say, well, we're shortage of water. I said, there's no shortage of water. The earth is two-thirds covered with water if the energy is, quote, over unity, so you could desalinate it and have it and pump it and place it wherever you want to. So these technologies, whether it's quantum vacuum, whether it's these advanced harmonic multiple phasic systems that electrolyze water into Brown's gas and can be a closed loop system, we know these have existed. We're actively looking for someone who actually can demonstrate this for us. These systems, would any one of them would be able to transition us out of this perilous centralized situation. And I think that one of the things we have to do is educate these elites, and this is, frankly, I spend a fair amount of time doing this, is that the whole mindset of centralized power and centralized both physical but also metaphorical power is an old paradigm. We need to let go of that. And it's hard because a lot of people get very addicted not to the money part of this whole game, but the kind of power they have. They kind of get off on that. And I think it's a psychological illness, frankly, and I think that it's something we have to be very careful of. This is why we're in the process right now of forming a nonprofit foundation that most of Arrow's assets and funds would be in once this gets going, so that no individual is sitting with a lot of resources. It would go into this foundation that will be committed to gifting these systems to poor areas in the world where, let's say, the system costs $5,000 or $10,000. Well, if it's a poor village in Asia or Africa, you might as well say $5 billion. They don't have it, so you're going to need to bring these systems out in a way that's cooperative with other agencies and foundations, so that the part of the world that's actually having an enormous amount of environmental destruction and poverty that could not afford to buy these systems would have them gifted to them or somehow placed in them in a way that would be supported institutionally. So we have to look at this almost as a global environmental and energy Marshall Plan is how I describe it. And I think it has to have that kind of thinking behind it. And we need to explain this in a way that the people who are in these elite circles understand that that's exciting. The vision of doing that is as exciting as amassing enormous amount of centralized power for themselves.
Yeah, though I think you're talking from your paradigm when you say exciting, because it's hard to imagine the mindset behind somebody who would help plan 911 and you know, be hiding in the shadows to help pull that off. It wasn't just the hijackers from Arabia that were involved. There were people on the inside who allowed that and enabled that to happen. And there's a mentality out there that we don't comprehend. And what's exciting to you and I, seeing the end of poverty and seeing the empowerment of every individual, is not what motivates them.
Well, you're right, but you know, I'm reminded of, you know, when we brought Tom Bearden and a group of these and scientists up to brief the Senate Environment Committee back in the year 2000, in October 2000, and I was doing an interview with Dr. Bearden, and he says, you know, now, friends, don't get me wrong, the fools may blow it yet, but we've still got to do this. And so my view of it is that, yes, there may be a recalcitrant or hardcore 10, 20, 30% of these folks who for whatever reasons, are hell-bent on this sort of meltdown scenario. But you know what? They're not going to prevail in the long run. And I think that, you know, you really, all you can do is articulate a better way. We have a whole group of people who do nothing but, frankly, meditate and pray for these people's enlightenment and guidance, and then take the right actions and teach by your own actions. And ultimately, it's going to be what it is. But I think that there are enough good people on the earth that the our better selves our higher self will prevail. It isn't going to be easy. I'm not trying to at all be Pollyanna. I've dealt with some very horrible things in my life, quite frankly, so I'm not one of these kind of like pie-in-the-sky, you know, Pollyanna guys. But I do think that we are seeing a big turning, even within these elite circles, towards acknowledging the problem and being supportive of the solution. Now, I think some of the solutions that you see in the press that they're supportive of, you were talking about the $100 billion in venture capital going into the clean tech energy stuff, it's all tinkering around the edges. It's too little, too late. What we need to do is come into the middle of that dynamic and present a technology that is a definitive solution. Now, interestingly, some people would say, well, those solutions are too good because they do threaten the status quo. And yet, at the same time, I think that we have to say, yeah, well, it's too bad. This is 2008 almost, not 1948 or 1908, and we really don't have time to talk about another 100 years to transition into technologies that I think through the minds of men, these sciences have been trying to emerge since the late 1800s and early 1900s, that we sort of have had this 100-year run of, if you will, a probation, and we've sort of run out the clock, and we have to now realize that we'll have to come forward with some bold initiatives. And I think people will get behind that. You know, I was encouraged. I was recently in Los Angeles and a meeting with some folks who are, you know, very well-known celebrities, A-list celebrities, who, as soon as we can present something that works and has been tested by independent laboratories and is reproducible, which is part of what we require, that it has to be scientifically reproducible, that they'll get behind it. And I think that we're going to see all walks of life, whether it's the sort of elements of this elite power structure, people in the public sector, people in the political realm that are open to these discussions that we've had meetings with. I was meeting with the presidential candidate not long ago talking about these things, and they're very excited about this being possible. A ranking member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee said, gosh, as soon as you have something like this, I would absolutely host you and your team to demonstrate this to our committee in the House of Representatives of the United States. I mean, I think there's we have a substantial network of people that are the friendlies, and I think that what the energy researchers out there need to hear is that they're not alone and that there is a big network they can plug into, and that we need to make this effort together to see if we can't make some bold initiatives here in the coming months.
One of the things we've not addressed yet is the inventor who comes forth with the technology that meets the criteria you're describing. The total pot is $5 million minimum, and then there's a $200,000 up front. Is this technology going to be open sourced, or is it not necessarily? Is that one of the criteria of you know, here's what you must agree to do if you're going to tap into our resources? Or,
no, I mean, this is all individually looked at, and what the objectives of the team are and the individual. We're just saying that we have the resources now to provide that level of support to someone who's got something that's legitimate, that's not snake oil, that can be reproduced and proven. Let's back this up. Open source is great, except one thing, and it has to be massively disclosed. It doesn't preclude it being protected, if that's the route that they would want to go. Open source is not a panacea either, because I can put the designs for a toaster on the Internet, and there's not one out of a million Americans that would know how to go down to Radio Shack and buy the elements and build that toaster. You're still going to have to somehow figure out how to capitalize, and I hate to use that word, but we live in the world we live in, so we have to deal with the world we live in, capitalize the building up of an infrastructure to not only disclose, and remember, when Kellogg's comes out with a new brand of cornflakes, they spend $60 to $80 million on prints and advertising to tell the public they have it. You cannot bring these systems out where you're competing with a $200 trillion asset base and the status quo without attracting some serious support so that it can go to the next phase of beta testing, engineering to a beta-tested model, and also build the infrastructure for distribution and manufacturing. That's going to be a capital-intensive process. It's not like Google or Yahoo or something where it's, you know, it's software, and basically, and the Internet servers. This is something that's a real industry that'll have to be built up. And I think that the question is, how do you do that? There are many ways to do it, but you have to be practical in how this is going to go forward. And open source is a very good way of letting people know there's a basic proof of doing this, but ultimately someone's going to have to find the way of putting together the friendly elements who have the resources to begin to build the systems and build the distribution and manufacturing capability so that John Q. Public can buy one of these, even if it's a generation 1.0 version of it, and begin to run their home on it and begin to transition out of fossil fuels. I think that one of the things that we're also looking for is to avoid the big mega and gigawatt systems, because those get into all the regulatory agencies that are mobbed up. And that if you stick with the smaller units where it can be an individual's home or business, or for that matter, car, if it's a transitional technology for automobiles, that you can get it out to the masses that way, and have it adopted. So we don't reject the idea of open sourcing. We just say that it has to include the ability to take it from something that's a media splash to something where you can actually have the capital and the resources to build it, because while some engineers think, oh, if I had the designs for this on the Internet, I could go down to a machine shop and build it for myself, I would say out of the 300 million people in America, I doubt there are more than a few hundred who would actually do that and take the time to do it. And not only that, it's not cost effective. So when you're dealing with a world with 6 billion people and you have 2.5 billion people in China and India rapidly industrializing using coal and the worst elements of the old creaking dawn of the Industrial Revolution that they're just now entering into, we're going to have some thinking that accounts for that and practically involved. And that's why we have brought on board of Aero some really excellent business people and manufacturing people who are really angels. They are totally heart and soul behind what we're doing and stand ready to help us move these things forward quickly once we find something worth doing that with.
One of the approaches that I've seen that really makes sense along the lines of open sourcing, inventor Sean Frain from MIT, he came up with what's called a wind belt. You take a little ribbon and the wind vibrates it back and forth. You put a magnet on the end of it. It goes back and forth between the coil, generates electricity. It's just a small amount. It's for like Hades and some of these third world countries. He's looking at $2 to $5 for a generator that would power your radio or, you know, turn on a light at night. And he has a hybrid approach in terms of open sourcing. He says there's no way you're going to want a patent in Haiti. It's just, you know, you're not going to get your money out of it.
Right.
But what you do is you patent in the developed world, and then all the rest of the world is open source. You put out a plan of how to build one of the things from scratch, off-the-shelf materials, and then the rest of the world has to license it. And so you kind of
That's a very good idea, actually, and one we'd be open to. And even then, ultimately, if you're wanting to have a generator that will do enough of the work to so they're not slashing down the rainforest to make charcoal to cook their meals, you're probably going to have a system where you actually have the whole system delivered there. And it's sort of like when they started building wells all throughout India and helping people so that they had fresh water. You're going to have to do the same thing throughout so much of the world. A lot of people forget in America and Europe that, you know, half the world lives on less than $2 a day. I mean, there's enormous poverty out there. And yet, those areas are also where there's some of the worst environmental degradation occurring, whether it's Amazon rainforest or throughout Asia. I mean, China is an environmental holocaust. I mean, it's absolutely beyond the pale at this point.
We have just about a minute before we need to wrap up here. We've not gotten to a question that I wanted to address in this segment, and that is the relationship between Disclosure Project and Seize Power and Aero. Maybe you can help us orient ourselves in terms of how those three organizations that you founded tie together and work together.
Web Disclosure Project is a 501c3 nonprofit that gets information and top secret military witness testimony out to the public, and it's informational, and again, it's a nonprofit. The C's was a predecessor to Arrow, and C's was closed down because we basically had a few $100,000 just to go and investigate and see what was out there, but not enough to really begin to support building systems. That wasn't the mandate of C's, actually. And when we discovered that we weren't going to find anything that was at the stage where it was ready to just go from identification to disclosure, we basically closed C's, so it doesn't exist now. And Arrow, we have stood up as an operation, and we have, in terms of angel funding, we have about $1 2/3 million now, just from, as I mentioned, angel funders who are willing to support what we're doing so that we can provide the funding, as we have recently in this contract, to this very good engineering group, and again, provide this upfront $200,000 licensing fee and award to Promising Technologies, and continue to do this. We don't, by the way, we don't have any paid staff for any of these organizations, not myself and not anyone else. I always tell people who want to work with me is that at this stage I'll pay you 10 times what I make, which is 10 times zero, which is still zero. But we have wonderful people who are putting up the resources so that we can do this other work. And so that's kind of how those projects have evolved. Really, Disclosure Project, which began in first as Project Starlight in 1992 and 3 when I was briefing the Clintons and the Rockefeller folks on this whole ET and UFO issue, discovered so many witnesses, and so much of our testimony began to track into the high-tech energy area that then it was a natural outgrowth that C's would then look for these systems and study them. And Arrow now is at the stage where we have enough to at least begin to stand up the efforts to financially really support people who have actually gotten to a certain milestone, and that is they're putting out a kilowatt of power. It can be reproduced. It's not snake oil. The system can have a closed-loop arrangement or what have you, et cetera, and so on. And actually, the criteria for that is at AERO2012.com.
Well, thank you, Steve, for joining us. It's been a great conversation, and we wish you the best in your endeavors.
Thank you. Appreciate your help.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.